Welcome back to our tribute to the Platters. I'm Jerry Pippin. 1953, that was the year the Platters got together. They soon would make record history, but in 1953, they were only an idea, a group just starting out in Hollywood. 1953 was an interesting year, basically a good year. The dictator of Russia, Joseph Stalin, had died. People in Washington thought the Cold War would thaw. Speaking of war, the Korean War ended in 1953. And entertainment in Hollywood? It was all comedy. Bob Hope, Steve Allen, Milton Berle, Martin and Lewis, all on television every week. Speaking of Martin and Lewis, the rumors already were going in 1953. Would Dean leave Jerry? I mean, after all, he had several top 10 singles that year. And one of those singles, well, it was That Samore.
In Napoli, where love is king, when boy meets girl, here's what they say.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling-a-ling, and you'll sing Vita Bella. Hearts will play, tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a guitarandella. When the stars make you drool, just like a pastifazool, that's amore. When you dance down the street with a clod at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. Excuse me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore.
When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore.
That's amore.
Bells will ring,
ting-a-ling-a-ling,
ting-a-ling-a-ling,
and you'll sing Vita Bella.
Vita Bella, Vita Bella. Hearts will play,
tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a gay tarantella.
Lucky fella.
Amore.
When you dance down the street with the cloud at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. But you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore.
Amore,
that's amore.
We're in the Las Vegas office of Gene Bennett, and Gene, talking about those days in L.A. back in 1953, you were already working for Buck Graham. You had just started. And you were showing your skills, I think, as a PR person.
And I started writing the personality plugger. It was born in about 1952 or 1953.
This is a newsletter.
Yeah, it was a newsletter. Uh-huh. And we had this office we were renting, and he said, you know, one day he said, why don't we go out and take a look at my garage? He said, I think we can make an office out there at the house. That would save on transportation,
sure.
Your transportation and everything. I said, okay. So there's a box. When we walked in, it was a bare garage, and there was a broken box, and there was music smeared on the floor. and with legal-looking papers. And I said, Buck, what is this? This looks like your music and legal papers. He said, yeah. He said, that's my old Noble catalog. He said, I wrote songs I wrote when I was back in New York and all, you know. I said, well, I'm going to take it back to the office. I'll gather it up and file it because it shouldn't be out here on a little scattered hole of the floor. He said, no, I guess you're right. So I threw it back, and in doing it, I came across this lead sheet and said, only you.
Wow.
And I read the lyric, and I thought, gosh, that's good. I like that. And I showed it to Buck. I said, what about this song, Buck? That's a nice song. He said, oh, my Lord. He said, I wrote that for Bill Kenney years ago. And he said, I forgot. Well, he said, before I could give it to him, he left the band and went back to Canada. And so it got filed away. I forgot all about it. So I said, well, I think it's a nice song. But so I laid it on the piano, and when Tony Williams, we had just met him, and he was starting to rehearse with Buck. It was about his second or third time coming. He picked up that music. He said, what's this, Buck? And Buck said, that is a song I wrote for Bill Kenney years ago and forgot to give it to him before he left. Or, you know, he got away before I could give it to him. Tony said, let's try it. And when he walked out that night, he said, Buck said, that's going to be the first song he records. And sure enough, we hadn't met Mercury or nothing by then. It was really brand new. And Tony, it was through Tony that we met the other three platters,
right.
Because his sister, Linda Hayes, was Linda Hayes.
Oh, Were they weren't really a group at all at that time? Just
well, they were, but they weren't with us. They were just, you know, Cornell Gunter was with them.
Oh,
and
really?
He had started it. Cornell started the Platters originally.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And Herbert Reed was, I think, the last one to come in, the bass. He was, they had trouble getting him to rehearse, you know. And so they ran into a girl that was a cousin to Herbert on the street. And they said, God, we are looking for a bass that'll stay with us. You know, we can't count on some of these guys that we've been using. And she said, hey, my cousin just got out of the Army. Said he was singing with that Wings Over Jordan choir. She said, he's got a big voice, bass voice. They said, where is he? You know, so she gave him the address, and they went to see, Alex Hodge and Cornell Gunter went to see and meet Herbert. And he said, oh, he jumped at the chance to come with them. And so then, before we met Tony through his sister, Linda Hayes, and before Cornell left, and Buck was rehearsing with Tony, and he said, you know, Tony, he said, he wanted to be a single. I mean, she introduced him as a potential single.
Right.
And he said, Buck said, I think you'd be better off right now with a coming trend, he said, to be with a group. He said, I think we should find, he said, you've got a great voice, and this is a good time for it, but he said, I think you need some voices, and it will give you a chance to get more confidence and everything, too. And Tony said, well, I happen to be kind of singing with some three other guys. He said, for Ralph Bass of King Records.
Mm-hmm.
King Federal,
famous,
Federal
famous,
Records,
famous,
yeah.
Rhythm and Blues.
Yeah, they were kind of hot, but the Platters hadn't done anything yet. And so Buck said, well, he said, if you want to talk to them, have them come over, and we'll consider. I'll sign them. I'll sign you, all of you, if they were agreeable. So they jumped at the chance, and we signed them.
And so there you have it, folks, the inside story on one of the greatest love songs ever recorded, Only You. By the Platters.
Only you can to make all this world seem right. Only you can to make the darkness bright. Only you and you alone can thrill me like you do and to fill my heart with love, for only you. Only you can to make a
mother's change in me. For it's true, you are my destiny. When you hold my hand, I understand the magic that you do. You're my dream come true, my one and only you. Only you can make all this change in me.
Gene Bennett of Personality Productions, right there from the beginning with the Platters. Tony Williams, when he agreed to go with the group, the Platters, had they already settled on that name?
They had settled on the name the Platters, yeah, before Tony even got there. Herbert Reed, I don't know, Herb claims he named them, but I think it turned out that it was really kind of a joint affair. They were listening to the radio and they were trying to figure out what to call themselves.
And back in those days, the DJ says,
yeah, he said, here, here's a platter, new platter and everything. And Herb says he spoke up, said, why don't we name them the Platters?
So the first recording?
No, they did some, Buck had done some uptunes,
okay.
And they were featuring David Lynch then. Mm-hmm. And Cornell left shortly after that. So they were without a lead singer, but Ralph Bass had the idea of having uptunes,
mm-hmm.
And so the several things that Ralph recorded with them was managed enough that they had recorded enough that King went ahead and put out this terrible album, including the day that they tried to do Only You and nothing went right. Zola was sick, Tony was out of kilter. It just didn't come off. It was horrible. And they ended up putting it out to make their 12 tunes. You know, because Buck said, oh, God, he gave up that day. He said, we're just not going to make this today. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, this will never be released. He said, get rid of that. Well, they didn't. They kept it. And then I'll be darned when we got our first album on Mercury, if they didn't come out right side by side and issued a single on Federal, that horrible version. And I could just imagine all those jukebox operators where we were hanging out every Monday, you know, to sell records.
Yep,
and they get all of the wrong record taken up and started on their jukebox. People say, well, that's not the Platters.
Yep.
It was horrible. But
The Platters and Only You was recorded for Mercury later again. I mean, did you go back in the studio and do it again? I guess.
Oh, well, when Mercury Records, they wanted the Penguins.
Right.
Because they had
right.
Earth Angel.
Uh-huh.
And that was the only real hit they had, but they were after, and we were managing them by that time. And Buck said, well, I'll give you the Penguins on one condition. He said, what is that? He said, you have to take the Platters. And I record the Platters. So they agreed.
So it was kind of a throwaway deal for them.
Yeah,
bigger than the Penguins ever thought
about. Turned
out
to be beyond their wildest dreams, you know. And I was counting up all the hits the other night and how they forced, I think, 8 or 9 years, they had chart hits, one right after.
Yeah, I know they had a lot of number one songs, Only You, The Great Pretender, that was one of their great songs.
Great Pretender. Only You went up to number 4.
We'll be back to find out the story behind the Platters. This is fun, Gene. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're saluting the group, I guess the super group, of the 50s and 60s, really. At least the 50s. The Platters. We'll be back.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
It just didn't look like anything I've ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippin Show.
Jerry Pippin!
Welcome back to the show. We're at the office of Gene Bennett, Personality Productions in Las Vegas. And Gene, we were talking about The Platters and Great Pretender and Only You, two of the greatest songs, really. Alan Freed, he was instrumental in making those successful, too, I think. In fact, you and Alan Freed have a history.
Alan Freed had just left Cleveland when I made my first rounds, and
this is a song plugger.
Yeah, Alan. Okay. Alan Freed. Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, you when but you said you made
on,
your first rounds,
yeah,
you were talking radio stations.
We started in when Only You was on the with I peddled Only You on the road. My husband and I took a vacation from California and went all the way back through, and we stopped at every town, and we loaded
go
with records,
radio
and we
station,
go
right,
in and
right,
put
right,
them
right.
Only You.
And now that was the way they did it back in those
yeah.
days.
Yeah, oh,
literally,
yeah.
you'd
Everywhere.
Go from town to town and meet the disc jockey, mm-hmm. and you didn't have to deal with a music director or program director.
Yeah.
If the disc jockey liked it,
yeah.
he could play it.
In Detroit, and the day I decided to drive down Gratiot Boulevard all by myself in our little Plymouth coupe
mm-hmm.
with the records,
right.
I got stopped, and the cop says, "Lady, you went through two red lights. I saw you. I was watching. You went through two red lights. This is on Gratiot." He said, "People don't live to go through many red lights on Gratiot Avenue here in Detroit." He said, "It's very dangerous." He said, "What are you, you know?" And I said, "Well, I said I've never driven in Detroit before. In fact, I hadn't been driving too long as it was." And he said, "Well," he said, "what are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm trying to get around to the stations, and it's so hard to try to, you know, find the stations and drive and everything." He said, "You want to take a piece of advice?" I said, "Sure." He said, "There's a parking lot right there." He said, "You swing over there and you park that car. There's a cab stand right there. And you get the cabbie and you tell him which stations you want. You've got the address. He'll take you around. You'll be back safe and sound in no time." You know, I said, "Sounds like wonderful advice to me." I knew I didn't dare not take it, you
yeah,
know.
Right.
So, sure enough, that's what I did. And, boy, it was a cold reception in Detroit. The program, the regular promotion man mm-hmm. was on vacation, and, you know, and everything. And I hammered and hammered and hammered. But I wasn't very happy with the reception I got. Then I went to Cleveland. And lo and behold, I walked in and I said, "I'm Gene Bennett from California, Personality Productions. I have a new record by the Platters called Only You that I want to..." And I didn't even get to finish. I said, "Oh, it's a hit here." I said, "Really? Really?" I said, "I just came from Detroit. It's a dud there." So they introduced me, and then I found out that there was a young man that wanted a record job promoting records. And he went to the distributor, and he deviled him. He said, "Please, give me a chance to prove. I know I can go out and promote records." So he says, "There's a whole stack. There's about 40 new records just came in. Now," he says, "you go through that thing, go through that pile, and you pick out one, and I'll give you a supply of records. You take them around. If you get some action,"
right.
he said, "I'll give you a job." He says, "You got a deal." So he sat there, and he screened all these records and come up with Only You. And picked it out of 40-some records.
You remember his name?
No, can't now. Can't remember. It's been a long time. That's, you know, I might have it in my record someday if I get to really do the research I need
oh,
to.
I'm
I might
sure
run
you
across.
Probably have it.
But anyway, so my work was all done by the time I hit Cleveland. Man, I got a reception from every disc jockey there. It was fantastic, you know, and it was such a shot in the arm that I needed so desperately at that time. But we were on our way from there. It really hit big in Cleveland.
So Cleveland's where it started, really,
yeah.
As far as the records.
And then John Sipple was a Billboard writer and also worked for Mercury, mm-hmm. off and on. He kind of switched back and forth. And he was in Seattle, but there was a Seattle disc jockey that Johnny took him to, and he played that, and it's a uh-oh thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, hey, what is that? And he was back, and he said, hey, that's a gimmick. That's good.
Yeah,
of course, Buck knew that. He made Tony do that, you mm-hmm. know, because he was after Tony to do something special, and his voice broke. And he said, that's it. Let's practice that. Let's see what we can do. And that was a thing that stuck out. That's a thing that the disc jockey started playing, and it hit in Seattle about the same time that it hit in Cleveland. And from there on, it just spread like wildfire.
You could say, well, it's a hit in Cleveland, Seattle, and all of a sudden it's
And all of a sudden.
Broadcasting's supposed to be an original business, but we all know it isn't. They want to know where it's been done first.
Yeah, that's true. Hitting that first one off of the ground is
the toughest part.
Yeah, but it was a fantastic.
Okay, now you got a hit record. The Platters gonna have to start making some personal appearances.
Oh yeah, well we were doing that. I was in Hollywood there. I was on the phone a lot, and I got a call from a Catholic lady that had a record shop, and she was calling on behalf of the Catholic priest downtown in Los Angeles. And she said, Gene, the Platters were making local history there. They were playing at the high schools. I one whole year we did high schools and all that kind of stuff. And she said, would you come down, she said, to Father Slee's church, Catholic church downtown here. She said, we have a very rough bunch of kids, and he's doing everything he can to get them off of the street and get them to come into the rec room or whatever. And she said, the Platters are so popular here in L.A. now. She said, would you bring them down? I said, sure. So we went down that night, and it was rough, those guys. But they ended up making a television show out of it. I'd love to get a copy of it. I know it's in the library down in L.A. somewhere. And it was the story of Father Slee and how he attracted the young people, the young Catholic kids that were on the streets more than off, you know, how he opened up the rec room and they ended up coming to church, and they had a tragedy where a boy and girl were killed in an accident, and that brought them in even more, mm-hmm. you know. But that night when we sang for them, or they sang for them, they followed us out and they stood under the street lamp. I'll never forget it. And all those kids sang Over You and sang Right Along and other songs and stuff with the Platters, you know. They just had to fall. And later on, they made a movie of that television of Father Slee.
Do you remember the first time the Platters played Vegas?
Oh, yes. Yes, I sure do. We got about 3 days' notice. They had a girl act that was bad, and they fired him. And they called up Buck and wanted to know if he would bring them down. And so we had to rush and make arrangements and get down there. And we got to work. It was over here at the Moulin Rouge.
Which
and they
was
were open.
A fantastic place.
Yeah.
Black operated place.
It was the only one
in town.
Everybody was welcome.
Yes.
Regardless of color.
And huge crowds late night.
Right. Everybody was coming over there.
Uh-huh.
But it was only open about 6 months. And we opened it, and we also closed it.
I didn't realize it was open that short of a period of time. It's such
they ran out
of
money.
History.
They ran out of money, and the Strip really didn't like,
that
much.
Of course not. It was competition at that point.
And it was the only one with open doors. So, we got paid off, and Herbie, they took all the money. They made him pay his share of the menus where they'd been eating. He always paid cash for his. He always ate hot dogs and stuff. They were eating steaks and putting it on the bill. And he had to pay half of the, bill, and he never got over it.
And he was eating cheap.
Yeah, he was eating cheap.
The rest of these guys were high on the hog, so to speak, as we say about Missouri and Oklahoma.
And they sort of took and divided it up five ways and gave them, demanded they pay. But it was funny. And so Buck said, you know what? He says, while we're all here, he said, I'm going to stop over and see my pal over at the Flamingo, and maybe he will let us audition for him. And that's what he did. He let them go in and let them audition, and in a matter of weeks, we were booked in on their revolving stage.
I've often wondered how the entertainers survived a whole set like that without being so dizzy you couldn't.
And part of the time you'd play into a blank wall because, you know, there was a part.
Round and round and round, right.
Oh, I tell you, but we played there for many weeks. And we had a gal keyboard player. She had a big bottom, and she stood up to play, and she wasn't very attractive. Lady D, I think her name was. Yeah, and when the entertainment director said to Buck, he said, "Gee, Buck," he said, "could you have picked out a little more attractive?" He said, "Oh, wait, you hear her play? She's fantastic and everything." So when we came back, he said, "I'll be sure you bring Lady D."
Yeah, right. That's the way it works.
So it worked.
Well, that's interesting. Now, Buck actually never—he's just an arranger and a manager and a writer.
Well, for many years he played saxophone,
he
arranged for
the
Dorsey
Platters.
Brothers, he liked to work with singers.
Early on, did you guys feel like the Platters were? The group
we felt
for.
That they would be, because Buck recognized that something in Tony's voice, and it wasn't developed at that time, but he felt that Tony had something that could be developed.
Now you left Buck Graham for a while and worked for Seymour Heller, didn't you?
No, that was I worked for them both simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
Because Buck couldn't afford to pay me in the beginning, so.
So you had to have a job.
So I had to have a job. Or he said, "Why don't you go over?" He said, "I think they're looking for some part-time help." And so I went over and introduced myself to Sam Lutz and Seymour Heller. And I started working afternoons. And then a lot of evenings I worked at the other office, or in the mornings I would drop in over there. And eventually I had a full-time job there. And I helped straighten out their office, because they had a gal by the name of Dixie something. She was a fiery redhead, a horrible shade of red hair. And when I walked in to go, when I first started that day, she said, "See that drawer down there on the left on my desk?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "That bottom drawer." She said, "Don't ever open it. If you hear it ringing, don't touch it." And I thought, drawer that rings? What kind of a thing is that? And she pulled it open. It was a red telephone. So I'd hear it ring from time to time, but I never did, you know, I never could figure out. But one day I walk in and Sam is sitting there, and she is working for, I'm working by then as Seymour's secretary, and we're doing busy things with Liberace, who's starting to really catch on and go across country and arranging fairs and all that kind of stuff. But Sam, he had Dixie, and I go in there, and he's sitting with his head in his hands, and I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Dixie's not coming back." "What the hell am I going to do?" You know? I said, "Well," and his desk was a total mess, had always been, and never, you know. He said, "Look at my desk." He said, "I'm afraid to let anything go, because I never see it again." The files, there was a bank of files in her office, and they were stacked to the ceiling with stuff that was unfiled. I said, "Why don't you let me file some of this?" "Oh, no, just leave it. I'll take care of it." So she was a bookie, evidently. She must have been booking.
That's what the red phone must have been.
That was what the red phone must have been, and she got into trouble. She probably spent some of the money or something, and she was on the lam. And so I helped Sam, and we also had a double entry set of books that we set up, because they had was working with single entry, and I thought, man, that's going to have to go someday, that's for sure. And I walked in there one morning, auditors was all over the place, and then they enlisted me to help with that. So I had a busy job the first through most part of 52 and early 53.
Okay, now.
On the next installment, Jean Bennett will talk about her career with Liberace. And, of course, we'll get back to the Platters. I'm Jerry Pippin.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well, I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day. I'll be seeing you in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.
That was the great Liberace. We can't do the Platters with Jean Bennett without covering all of her musical career, and she worked with all of the greatest ones, including Lawrence Welk, Liberace, and Bob Horn. You don't know who Bob Horn was? Have you ever heard of the American Bandstand with Bob Horn? He was there before Dick Clark. We'll be back. In the next hour, we'll concentrate more on the Platters and their great music. And Gene has some great stories. So stay tuned for the next hour for the story of one of the greatest music groups of the century, the Platters. I'm Jerry Pippin.